This is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
There's a lot of conversation these days about whether to levy more taxes, especially on corporations and the wealthiest individuals. Today on Freakonomics Radio, wouldn't it be a good start to collect the taxes that are already due but aren't being paid? And what if you could choose, even just a little bit, how your taxes will be used?
Let's stir some competition by actually creating a market mechanism where the citizens can choose.
And what if you could also choose a small gift in return for your tax donation?
So for all intents and purposes, it's no different from shopping on Amazon.
Would this actually work?
I'm skeptical about how far you can get with the carrot approach.
Are you skeptical? You'll have a chance to figure it out right after this. Last week, we started looking at how to make paying taxes more enjoyable, or at least less painful. We first heard from Catherine Eckel, an economist at Texas A&M University, who has looked at altruism.
Altruism goes up when there's more of a reason to give the money away.
Eckel and a colleague ran an experiment comparing how much money people would give to a charity versus the government if they could choose how the money would be spent.
And what we found, to our shock and astonishment, was that people would give almost as much to a government organization as they would to a private organization.
And this got her thinking.
If there was a little bit of scope for people to direct their money, that would increase tax compliance.
Just how big a problem is tax non-compliance? Every year, Americans short the IRS nearly $500 billion.
The best estimate we have is that for federal taxes, about 16% of what should be remitted is not.
That's Joel Slemrod, a professor of economics at the University of Michigan. Now, that 16% tax gap isn't generally coming from your average employees who get W-2 forms from their employers. As Slemrod said, tax noncompliance mostly comes from another group of workers.
On the other hand, if your income is self-employment income where there is no third-party reporting, they think that number goes from 1% to over 60%.
To over 60% noncompliance? How is that even possible? Well, note exactly what Joel Slemrod said.
If your income is self-employment income where there is no third-party reporting.
That is, if you work for yourself and someone pays you directly, they don't necessarily generate a tax document the way an employer does. Say you run a restaurant or a construction company or a farm. The IRS doesn't know how much money you actually made because nobody told them. It's up to you to give the IRS a figure. And they don't have the right to request your bank records unless you're already being audited on suspicion of tax cheating. So without third-party reporting, people with self-employment income have a real temptation to lower the income they report. And then there's income from business partnerships and investments, all of which tends to be fairly opaque and also tends to accrue to wealthier people who have greater resources for what you might call tax management. All this underreported income is responsible for about 80% of that nearly $500 billion tax gap. The rest is due to underpayment or outright non-filing. But these are all forms of tax evasion, which, to be clear, is not the same as tax avoidance. What's the difference?
Well, technically, the difference is that avoidance are legal ways to reduce your taxes and evasion are illegal. I think the nicest description of that comes from Dennis Healy, who was Chancellor of the Exchequer in the UK. And he said the difference between avoidance and evasion is the thickness of a prison wall.
And lest you think tax evasion is a new problem, think again.
If you look back in recorded history, some of the earliest things we know about societies have to do with tax payments and tax evasion.
For millennia, taxation has been perhaps the most powerful tool, some might say weapon, that a government or crown can wield. Countless rebellions and revolutions were driven by tax issues, our own revolution included, at least to some degree. In 1774, Alexander Hamilton warned his fellow colonists that if Britain's appetite for taxation were left unchecked, all the Americans' tables and chairs and knives and forks and everything else would be taxed, along with every child and every kiss your daughter received from their sweethearts. The earliest records of tax avoidance go back to the 7th century BCE in Egypt, where aging patriarchs would transfer property to family members to avoid inheritance taxes. Avoidance and evasion have continued pretty much unabated ever since. In 17th century England, for instance,
they wanted to have a tax on real estate that was higher the more grand your residence, but it wasn't easy to get a sense of the value of a residence. So what could you easily observe that would be an indicator of how fabulous your residence was? Well, first they tried fireplaces. The problem is that you have to have somebody go inside. What is correlated with the grandness of your home for which you don't have to go inside? Windows. So for centuries, there was a tax based on how many windows a house in England had.
How did the glaziers and glassmakers respond to the window tax?
There was some extra business because, as always, when there is a tax, the creative juices of avoidance and evasion get rolling. So what you can still observe to this day in England is older houses where it's clear there was once a window and then it was bricked up to reduce window tax. We also know there were cases where windows would be installed that would allow light to come into two different rooms. So the glaziers had some business there.
I'm curious about where an action like that would fall on the line between avoidance and evasion.
Yeah, I would call that avoidance, except if I got word that the tax inspector was coming by and I bricked up my window the week before, and then after the inspector passed, I unbricked it. That one maybe sounds like evasion.
Another odd tax that's been levied throughout history is the bachelor tax, since, as everybody knows, unmarried men cause nothing but trouble, which must be paid for. This tax also led to some novel workarounds.
In at least one country that had a bachelor tax, there was an exception that if you could prove that you had asked a woman to marry you and she had refused, then you were exempt from the tax. So a market arose for what were called professional lady rejectors, who for a fee would fill out the form saying, yes, you had asked them for their hand in marriage and they had refused, and you would take this to the tax office and be exempt from the bachelor tax.
There's been a lot of talk lately, especially among Democrats running for president, of instituting new wealth taxes in the U.S. Knowing what we now know about professional lady rejectors and bricked-up windows, you can imagine that the U.S. billionaires targeted by a new wealth tax would likely prove quite adept at avoidance, if not outright evasion. That's been the case in several European countries where wealth taxes have been tried. As one recent OECD report put it, the revenues collected from net wealth taxes have, with a few exceptions, been very low. In France, for instance, more than 40,000 millionaires left the country between 2000 and 2014. For what it's worth, the U.S. has some advantages. Unlike many European countries, for instance, the U.S. already requires its citizens to report income to the IRS, regardless of what country they live in. But given the seemingly eternal and universal urge to avoid paying taxes, one imagines that other creative solutions would be found. So, what's a country to do if it wants to increase tax compliance? Here's one clue. The IRS reports that 96% of respondents to an independent poll agreed with this statement. It is every American's civic duty to pay their fair share of taxes. But when asked why they pay, 62% answered fear of an audit.
One thing we've learned is that any kind of correspondence tends to increase tax compliance, maybe because taxpayers just get a correspondence and say, oh my gosh, the IRS knows I exist, and they didn't realize that before.
So you're more stick guy than carrot.
I'm more of an incentive guy, so either carrots or sticks are incentives, but among incentives, I think the evidence suggests that sticks work better than carrots.
But, Slemrod says, the IRS doesn't have a very big stick.
The real budget of the IRS is down over 20% since 2010. Audits are down a third.
This despite the fact that an audit can return as much as $4,500 per hour of IRS labor.
In my view, I think it's the wrong direction for sure.
And if you are caught, generally what happens is that then you have to pay them and a little bit more.
That, again, is Catherine Eckel.
So there's not a huge penalty associated with failing to pay your taxes.
I mean, on one hand, the gospel is that everybody hates taxes.
And that is Kate Lamberton of the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School of Business.
But on the other hand, I saw this data from the World Value Survey that said, you know, we really feel like we should pay them. You know, it's a really small percentage of people who say it's okay to cheat on your taxes. So as much as we hate them, we tend to comply.
Lamberton is a marketing professor.
Which means I study consumer behavior, which is basically the psychology behind the way that people make decisions with money.
While it is true that many people pay taxes because they're afraid of getting caught if they don't, Lamberton points to another, more encouraging reason for compliance.
Well, there's been quite a bit of research done on social pressure, right? So if you feel like everybody else is paying, then you feel like you probably should as well. Trust in government certainly has an influence. If you don't trust your government, then what's the point of giving them your money? People could also seek to avoid negative emotions, like they don't want to feel shame.
But wouldn't it be nice if people could feel not just not bad about paying taxes, but actually feel good? That's essentially what Catherine Eckel was going for in a follow-up to the experiment she did about disaster relief. In that one, you will recall,
people would give almost as much to a government organization as they would to a private organization.
But how much of this effect was because people could specify where their money was going, something we can't do when paying taxes?
And so we looked around and we found this amazing fund called the Gifts to the United States Fund. We didn't even know it existed before, but it does. It's a real thing. You can write them a check. And then we designed a new experiment that compared people's giving to that fund.
In this experiment, she compared what people were willing to give to the fund without knowing how the money would be spent.
That's like really voluntary taxation, because you have no control over how it's going to be used.
Versus the amount people would give if they could earmark their money for a specific purpose. Cancer research, for instance, or affordable housing.
So when people know that their money is going to be used for a cause that they support, they're much more willing to part with it than otherwise.
How much more? Eckel's study found that they were twice as likely to give to a specific cause than to the general fund, and they donated roughly 2.5 times more. So it would seem that being allowed to allocate your tax dollars might significantly increase compliance. It's an idea Kate Lamberton has also been studying.
So none of us likes to be forced to do things, right? I don't have a choice about paying my taxes. And that in itself, even if I feel a civic duty, makes it kind of an unpleasant task. Even people who would feel predisposed feel a certain sense of what's called reactance. So they push back against it.
There's another factor that can make paying taxes unpleasant.
The other factor is the decoupling.
Meaning that paying in your tax money isn't coupled with any sort of tangible benefit the way it is when you buy something for yourself.
The benefits are very diffuse. It's kind of like you're seeing something from a more distant vantage point. The benefit looks smaller, the cost looks bigger.
One way to change taxpayers' minds, or at least inform them about how their money is being spent, is to make the data accessible.
The Obama administration had a website where you could go and put in the amount of tax you paid and see what it was spent on. And those interventions have pretty mixed results, because one would argue all they do is address recoupling. All they do is reconnect the payment to the benefit. They don't introduce any ideas about agency. So what we wanted to do was to try to address both of these things with one intervention.
Here's the intervention that Lamberton and her colleagues came up with.
So we said, what if we don't just give you the pie chart? We let you say how you would like the money to be allocated across that pie chart. And in one study, in a lab study, we could show that tax compliance changes when people have the opportunity to express their opinions about the way their taxes are spent.
Again, I want to point out that the subjects of a lab experiment like this aren't necessarily responding the way people in the real world will respond. Nevertheless, the results from Lamberton's study suggest that getting to allocate your own tax dollars, at least to some degree, could increase compliance by up to 15%.
If you let people have a voice in the way their tax dollars are spent, they're much more satisfied with paying them.
Okay, great. But there is a fly in this ointment. The kind of spending the average taxpayer might like isn't necessarily the spending a government might need to make.
It's hard because some categories are inherently more appealing. Perhaps they're more personally relevant to people.
For instance, education and medical research and military spending, all of these have obvious concrete constituencies. Whereas paying down the interest on the national debt or funding long-term infrastructure, not so sexy.
There are things that are completely non-transparent to most of us. I think that that's a reason why a 10% allocation makes sense.
Meaning a taxpayer could specifically allocate just 10% of their total tax bill.
There is work going on all the time that taxes pay for that, you know, we notice when it's not done. We don't notice when it's done. And those things do need to be protected and they do require investment.
To Lamberton, the idea of allocating a portion of your personal tax bill is worth bringing out of the lab and into the real world. In the U.S., a process called participatory budgeting has been tried by some local governments, and often
there's a vigorous debate about the way money should be spent. And there is a little bit of a danger there because then you end up with the people in the room who care the most, and those people likely have pretty strong opinions about what's going on.
Lamberton likes to think this could work better on the federal level and without the need for public debates. For starters, there's already a mechanism on the federal tax form.
So we have a little box on our tax form that we can check to direct money to the presidential campaign fund, right? That is a very simple introduction of agency that's just a yes-no. It does seem to me possible that we could expand that expression of agency.
But is there a concern that participatory budgeting would radically realign the actual federal budget? Based on the evidence from her research, Lamberton doesn't see that happening.
So in the aggregate, what ends up happening in the U.S. at least is the defense budget, which is a huge portion of the pie, goes down. And I will say that's in part because our participants tended to be slightly more liberal than the population as a whole. But a lot of the other budgetary categories don't change an enormous amount. So while on an individual level you might see big change, in the aggregate, it actually isn't a seismic shock that would be that different from what you would see when an administration changes.
Okay, if you believe that giving people some power over their tax payments will increase tax payments, what's the next logical step?
The hometown tax system is absolutely fantastic.
Coming up after the break, we travel to Japan with the thought of stealing one of their very interesting tax ideas. We'll be right back. You are listening to Freakonomics Radio.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by TransferWise, a new way to send and receive money internationally. More than 6 million people and businesses in 70 countries use TransferWise. More at TransferWise.com or on the app. And by Progressive Insurance, offering Snapshot, a device designed to reward safe drivers. Learn more at Progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Now that's Progressive.
This is Freakonomics Radio with your host, Stephen Dubner.
Hello, mushy mushy.
That is Jesper Kohl. He's an economist by training, originally from Dusseldorf, Germany.
I have been stuck in Tokyo for the last 35 years.
These days, he works for the financial firm WisdomTree. Before that,
I first worked for 3 years in Japanese politics and then moved on into the world of finance, being the chief economist and head of research for both Merrill Lynch and JP Morgan.
So Kohl is fairly steeped in Japanese politics and economics, which, we should say, he adores.
I mean, I've said this time and again, I want to be reborn as a 23-year-old Japanese.
Kohl has been called the last optimist about Japan, whose economy has for decades been marked by stagnation and even deflation. Japan's citizenry is aging. Despite labor shortages, the country's traditionally been reluctant to allow foreign workers, although that's finally changing. The economic doldrums are severe enough that Prime Minister Shinzo Abe recently announced a $120 billion stimulus package. But Jesper Kohl isn't worried.
The Japanese economy is the envy of the world in the sense that it actually balances multiple outcomes, whether it is economic freedom, whether it is equity, whether it is growth. You find that overall the outcome that the economy produces for the citizens of Japan is absolutely fantastic.
That said, even an optimist of Cole's intensity admits there are structural issues.
The Japanese economy ultimately is very much a two-tiered economy in the sense that you've got the economic concentration in the mega cities, Tokyo, Osaka, and Nagoya. Those three centers effectively account for about three quarters of Japan's employment and value add creation. So the hinterland, the rest of the country, you know, effectively is always in deficit. And that, if you look at the Japanese national budget, is also reflected in a very big redistribution effort. If the budget in Japan is about 80 trillion, you find that almost 20 trillion go to redistributing funds from the rich urban centers into the regions of the economy.
By the way, those trillions Cole is talking about are yen, not dollars. In any case, what's happening in Japan, the imbalance between cities and the hinterland, is not so different from what's happening in many countries, including the U.S., as the world gets more urbanized. But in Japan, it is extreme. 94% of the Japanese population lives in urban areas. In the U.S., that number is just over 80%. The trend in Japan, as elsewhere, is that young people who grow up in rural areas eventually move to the big city, which leaves their hometown with an aging population and a depleted tax base. To fight this problem, Japan introduced in 2008 what's called a hometown tax system, or furusato nozei. It allowed people to make donations to their hometowns, which, after the first 2,000 yen, or roughly $20, can then be deducted from their personal taxes. But here's the thing. The donation, despite the name, didn't actually have to be to your own hometown. You could direct the money to any region. Nor did you even have to be from a rural area to take advantage of the hometown tax. And here's maybe the most Japanese thing about the hometown tax. When you made a donation to a particular region, they would send you something nice in return.
It was brilliant in the conception, in the sense that there was a strong realization that, yes, the bureaucrats at the central government are doing a perfectly fine job of redistributing from the urban centers into the regions, but let's stir some competition by actually creating a market mechanism where the citizens can choose which regional products they want to buy and create an incentive by making those products tax deductible from their national tax, you know, thereby creating competition amongst the different villages, amongst the different regions, and creating entrepreneurial spirit in the sense that entrepreneurs are now actively marketing their products.
My understanding was that when you were filing your taxes, you could direct a portion of your local payment to anywhere else. And in exchange for that, quote, donation or direction, that those local towns or prefectures would then send me some kind of gift, some kind of thank you.
It was never a gift. It was never a gift. It was very conscious policy. You know, there's whole catalogs of the goods that I want to buy. So it's not as though I get a random gift. I know perfectly well that the only thing from Nagano I'm interested in is this local brewer who has this excellent micro beer. It's no different from shopping on Amazon. You know, you've got by different prefecture, by different villages, you've got the list of the approved products. And this is effectively what I buy with my donation.
Most of the products are food or beverages, local delicacies, specialty seafood, microbrews. Elsewhere, a handmade sword by a master swordsmith, available for a tax donation of around $45,000. One agricultural town known for its high-grade beef and bell peppers attracted around $38 million in directed donations, the most of any municipal government, even though 90% of its donors had no connection to the town. In 2018, hometown tax donations in Japan totaled more than $4.5 billion. Jesper Cole notes that one criticism of the program is that it disproportionately benefits higher-income households, since the maximum tax donation is in part a function of your income. But it's also worth noting that charitable giving in Japan is not nearly as prominent as it is in the United States.
No, you make a very, very important point. Tax-deductible donations for charity are very, very difficult to do. To set up a foundation, to set up a nonprofit that actually is eligible for tax deduction, sometimes takes 5 to 6 years, even if you've got support from the highest levels. So effectively, the hometown tax system is the most direct and most frequently used part of tax deductibility that is actually available.
Is it made so difficult as a means of fraud prevention, or is there another reason?
Correct. It is made very difficult for fraud prevention. You know, contrary to the American perception, Japanese are extremely entrepreneurial. And if you've lived in deflation for one generation, trust me, you know how to eke out an additional 1 yen or 1 nickel.
So the hometown tax scratches a variety of itches. It redistributes income from the big urban areas. It gives people, at least high-earning people, a way to contribute to specific causes, since many towns advertise what the funds will be used for. And it rewards donors with nice stuff. It also, as Jesper Cole likes to argue, drives the entrepreneurial spirit.
It has actually created competitions with the different regions, whether it's Nagano, whether it's Hokkaido, whether it's Okinawa, now competing to offer their products to the customers. This is not about building bridges to nowhere, which is what sometimes the Japanese central government construction ministry likes to do, but it's actually creating genuine private sector entrepreneurship. If you're in a local village and you're a microbrewer, trust me, the scheme is incredibly important.
You could also imagine the hometown tax nudging people toward higher tax compliance. At least that's the hope. For one thing, you have to actually file a tax return in order to get the deduction. In any case, not everyone is as bullish on the hometown tax idea as Jesper Cole. Other economists offer a number of criticisms. A lot of time and money is devoted to marketing a region's products to the big city taxpayer. The system can also result in a wildly uneven redistribution of funds. For instance, the town famous for its beef and bell peppers, it took in $38 million. It only has 70,000 households. And, of course, all that tax money flowing to the hinterlands means that Japan's big cities, which continue to grow, are losing revenue. I asked Jesper Cole if there'd been other unintended consequences.
It's very interesting. So unintended consequences are that the local governments have begun to cheat, which is to say that, you know, the local government will throw in an extra gift. In one case, the mayor offered for you to sit in the seat of the mayor's office for 1 day. There was one famous case where one of the villages would throw in for free a handmade piano. So the local politicians said, this is great. We can actually boost our local revenue base by attracting more money from the people living in Tokyo or in Osaka. And as a result of that, they started to abuse the system.
In response, the government has tweaked the regulations about the types and value of gifts that can be marketed. Some prefectures used to offer Amazon gift cards, but they've been banned since they don't spur local production. Also, a cap was placed on the value of a gift. It can be no more than 30% of the tax donation itself. I asked Jesper Cole, who went to college in the U.S., if he would suggest some version of the hometown tax here.
Absolutely. I think that the key point is, you know, how can I create a hybrid structure where, yes, I can use national policy to actually create incentives for local entrepreneurs to produce locally and to increase their sales, to increase the brand awareness of their products, you know, on the global stage, that's where the hometown tax system is absolutely fantastic.
Kate Lamberton, the Wharton marketing professor, sees the Japanese hometown tax idea as tricky territory.
People generally feel a strong responsibility to pay taxes. I think that one of the dangers there that Japan is facing in the long term is that they've taken that intrinsic motivation and they've translated it into something that's extrinsic now.
This problem is called motivational crowding out. Consider the idea of paying students to get better grades. Some research shows a short-term improvement, but other research raises concerns that in the long term, you're killing off a kid's natural desire to learn and replacing the potential joy of discovery and mastery with anxiety over test results. The hometown tax data from Japan suggests there is some motivational crowding out. A municipality that rewarded donors with a gift was 6.5 times more likely to get a donation than towns that didn't.
So say they do away with this program. What happens now is people say, well, I used to get cool stuff for paying my taxes. I don't get cool stuff anymore. So now that intrinsic motivation has been eroded and the extrinsic motivation has been taken away, it's possible that in the long term, what they end up seeing is a higher level of noncompliance than they did before this program existed.
Economists are really focused on incentives.
Catherine Eckel again from Texas A&M.
And they believe really strongly that if you give somebody an incentive to do something, that they're more likely to do it. But there's more and more evidence emerging that incentives can break a system that's already working without incentives. So a situation where people trust each other or people engage in reciprocity and help each other out, if you introduce incentives and then you take them back off again, you might have broken the system that's there before.
It's highly unlikely we'll ever see anything like Japan's hometown tax in the U.S. But what if, as both Eckel and Lamberton would like to see, the U.S. started offering taxpayers the opportunity to direct a portion of their money to particular departments or agencies? Would we start to see what the Japanese saw? Marketing campaigns and competition to solicit the most donations? And do we really want government agencies campaigning for our money?
You know, to the extent that people don't notice what government does, it would not be a bad thing for agencies to say, look, here's what we do. Here's what your life would be like without us. An increased awareness of what government does in our lives could, to me, only be a positive.
Lamberton even thinks it might improve the average citizen's relationship with the government.
I've talked about some with this idea. They say, well, look, this would work the first time. People think something's going to happen, and then they see that it doesn't. And it would mostly create enormous frustration and, in fact, could have a backlash effect. And I would argue that even that conversation would be helpful. Creating a higher level of civic engagement, to me, that's not a negative. So you introduce agency, you also then introduce accountability and raise people's involvement with the taxpaying process and the federal or state allocation process. Could it raise frustration? Sure. However, I think it's a very valuable conversation.
Coming up after the break, we visit London to catch up on the latest adventures and misadventures in the behavioral science revolution.
And maybe cabin crew on short-haul flights should be penguins, trained to say very pointedly, I'm afraid we have run out of ice.
That's right after this.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by TransferWise, a new way to send and receive money internationally. More than 6 million people and businesses in 70 countries use TransferWise. More at TransferWise.com or on the app.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the host of Freakonomics Radio, Stephen Dubner.
A few months ago, Freakonomics Radio traveled to London for a live show on a topic of great interest to us.
Thank you so much. We were recording live tonight in London.
where nearly 10 years ago, a quiet revolution began. It was headquartered at the very center of the UK's central government, and it promoted something that you wouldn't think would necessarily need promoting, which was government policymaking based on actual empirical evidence. Wouldn't it make sense for governments to design policy based on such research rather than on opinion polls or personal whim, or worse yet, the highest bidder? This was the revolutionary idea behind the establishment in 2010 of the Behavioral Insights Team, or as it's more commonly called, sometimes with affection, sometimes ridicule, the Nudge Unit. Their mission was to translate social science research into simple and inexpensive policy ideas that would help collect taxes more efficiently, get the unemployed back to work faster, perhaps even increase happiness and well-being. And so tonight, we have come to the epicenter of this revolution to learn its history, its progress and failures, and its future. Now, we should say the Nudge movement has not been without its critics. It's been accused of overreach, of arrogance, of naivete. The entire enterprise calls for a certain amount of skepticism, and so we have asked to join us tonight a professional skeptic. He's also host of the Bugle podcast and a professional cricket commentator. Would you please welcome the great Andy Zaltzman?
Hello, hello. Thanks for having me.
Have you, do you have any thoughts on this Nudge movement / revolution?
So, I don't understand economics, and I sincerely hope I die that way. I'll consider that a life very well lived if I get to the end of my life, still unable to understand this mysterious witchcraft. Fundamentally, it's witchcraft in a pinstripe suit. Economics is the art of telling people exactly what's going to happen and then explaining why it didn't. But anyway, Nudge theory was developed, of course, by the Mafia, one of the world's most enduringly successful franchises. Now, nudging had a resurgence after a scheme that put pictures of insects in urinals in a Dutch airport, because men are notoriously easily distracted as a species. And it was found that giving them a target to aim at, this provided a little incentive to stop spraying the entire room with unstoppable jets of WAS. So it was highly successful. It was all about gentle prods to change behavior rather than extreme threats, because one of the flaws in us as a species, the human race, is that we don't really care about massive existential threats. You know, with the big nudge of the increasing prospect of a relatively imminent and high-grade Armageddon doesn't seem to be motivating enough as a species. It's too big and it's too vague. So perhaps, you know, smaller nudges might work. Maybe all plastic bags should be forced to be shaped like a dolphin. Might make us think more carefully about them. And maybe cabin crew on short-haul flights should be penguins, trained to say very pointedly, "I'm afraid we have run out of ice."
Andy Zaltzman, your perspective is most appreciated. Let's hear now what the actual Nudge practitioners have to say. Our guest is a psychologist and political scientist by training who's career has toggled between government service and academia. It was he who launched the Nudge Unit under Conservative Party Prime Minister David Cameron. Years earlier, he worked in the Prime Minister's Strategy Unit under Labour Party PM Tony Blair. Would you please welcome the chief executive of the Behavioral Insights Team, David Halpern? So, David, as I understand it, you created the Nudge Unit with a 2-year sunset clause in case it wasn't working. At the beginning, what probability would you have assigned to the likelihood that it would turn out the way it actually has?
I think certainly no more than 50-50. That was why we set it up with a sunset clause. Governments across the world are full of units that people set up that seemed a good idea and they never get around to shutting down. And of course, that's true for a lot of government policy. You set things up, we don't know whether they work, and we carry on doing them nonetheless.
So of all the projects that BIT, the Behavioral Insights Team, has rolled out regarding energy savings and tax compliance, and I guess the biggest one is using automatic enrollment to increase pension savings, if you could put a number on it, what would you say is the median rate of improvement overall?
So one of the key points is most things don't work. And that's actually quite a difficult truth for people to come to terms with. There's probably half a dozen which are sort of billion-dollar impact plus. And then you've got quite a lot of things which are quite small impacts and lots that don't work.
Name a billion-plus project, please.
Top ones would be things like pensions, it's a famous one, getting people to pay their tax on time, now very widely used and replicated across the world. Less well-known interventions on e-cigarettes, we think is definitely $1 billion plus in terms of its impact.
So e-cigarettes in the States, as I'm guessing you know well, are going toward the direction of what looks like it may be not a total ban, but very, very significant regulation. Can you tell the story of e-cigarettes here?
So we took a view back in 2010-11 when the first reaction of a lot of folks in the health community was we should ban these things. And we felt on the basis of addictive behavior, you're trying to introduce a substitute, it's likely to be pretty effective. That was very controversial at the time. More recent reviews by Public Health England estimate that, circa 40,000 extra smokers a year quit. So that is an absolutely enormous effect size if you work it out. Even if you discount it in the future, that is easily $1 billion a year impact.
There's a lot of advocacy against what's called harm reduction, right? People don't want to introduce something that's a half step. So in this case, the use of nicotine, but not delivered through a cigarette. Who were the biggest rivals of the suggestion that e-cigarettes be allowed?
Yeah, well, the whole industry, remember, understandably, we spent 30 years working against tobacco, and then someone comes along with a thing that looks a lot like a cigarette. You can understand the deep suspicion. So you've got a whole set of institutional and professional first instincts which are against.
Now, the U.S. is moving probably toward a much stricter regulation than here. Have you had conversations with public health officials there? What would you say to them to suggest that perhaps your route is long-term a better route?
Yeah, well, we did take the view that we should regulate them. So, for example, we really didn't want them sold to kids. We didn't want them to recruit new folks. There are regulations around, are they safe? Like, will they literally blow up? Regulations around dosage. There are actually quite a lot of regulations. So it's not that we didn't have it regulated. In fact, that was one of the key points, that it really matters that they do deliver enough nicotine to actually be effective. That remains, as it happens, an open issue because the regulation stops the level of strength. So it's not that it's not regulated.
So let me break into the live show for a second to say that e-cigarettes in the UK have been handled quite differently than in the US, where, as you've likely heard, there have been more than 30 deaths and many serious injuries from vaping. To hear more about this difference, you can listen to our podcast episode number 398, The Truth About the Vaping Crisis, because if you've only been reading the headlines about vaping in the US, then you're missing out on a lot of the story. Okay. Back to our interview with the founder of the Behavioral Insights team, David Halpern.
So let's talk about the tax revenues produced by better letter writing. Walk us through, what was the problem? What were the proposed and trialed solutions, and what turned out to be most effective?
So if you think about it, most revenue services, they're in the business of trying to get people to do something which they may or may not be super happy to do, which is to pay their taxes. On the other hand, you definitely don't want to pay your neighbor's taxes if they're not. But for example, Stephen, in the unlikely event you are late paying your tax, you'll get a letter saying, come on. And they would send the same letter to everyone, which is some form of threat or whatever. And then famously, the early trial was, why don't we just tell people something which is true, which is most people pay their tax on time. And adding that one line, 9 out of 10 people pay their tax on time, would that lead to people then just paying up without further prompt, with no further action? And the answer is yes, it did. And indeed, we tried multiple variations. Back then, that was unbelievably controversial. I just can't tell you how difficult it was. Well, it was felt lots of reasons why. What you want to start experimenting on people, and the system wasn't built to do it. There were even questions about how would you analyze it?
Andy Zaltzman, have you ever gotten one of these lovely tax letters?
Not that I've noticed, but I don't often open my post. But tax is essentially the original form of crowdfunding. But yeah. But it's got a bad reputation over the years. Really, it needs to be done more positively. So do it like an appeal, almost like a charity. So get a leaflet saying, sponsor a new chemistry lab in your local school. And that's basically what tax, isn't it? Or, get Deirdre a new hip instead of just saying you've got to pay your tax. Make it more positive. And also, let's have some gratitude. Let's have a nice thank you letter. Dear Mr. Zaltzman, thank you very, very much for your tax. People have been so generous this year, and I'm telling you what they spent it on.
Well, you may be joking, but I think half those ideas at least are worth testing.
We can build a better world.
Yeah. There is some evidence of giving people some say in what do you want to pay your tax on. I'll say no to the nuclear warheads, but I'll say okay to the, if there was a marginal extra pound or dollar, what would you prioritize? that actually people do feel better about it. And one of the quite deep questions even buried in there is that people do feel quite good when they give money to charities, right? In fact, as you'll know from the behavioral literature, better than they think they'll feel. Why not when they pay their taxes? Why wouldn't you feel good that you're supporting schools and hospitals and so on? So one of the objectives of a tax authority, in my view, should not only be to collect the revenue, but actually have people feel okay about it. Why not?
It's lovely to hear about all these successes and impressive. I would like to hear a spectacular failure, please.
Do you want to hear some of the things that didn't work?
All of them.
So images of homes showing, infrared images showing how much heat they're losing, putting that on a request to get your home insulated, turns out to make people significantly less likely to get their home insulated. There was good lab work suggests it was a good idea, you know, but it looks like people are going, oh, that looks warm, that's cozy, I'll keep with that. Getting people who go to a major airport to switch to public transport, really big effort, did absolutely diddly squat. A grit-based intervention. We did a number of interventions with 16, 17-year-olds. Some have worked incredibly. But we found the grit-based intervention, at least in the UK, it did increase attendance rates, but it didn't increase the pass rates. One was getting managers to be more sympathetic towards basically senior female staff. We spent a long time with a lot of academics designing this perfect intervention. It had exact reverse effect. Getting male managers to be attentive in this particular way, you know, they actually were less ultimately sympathetic.
And did it produce a bunch of sexual harassment lawsuits in the process?
No, it didn't work. But it does matter. It's interesting. They are much less memorable, kind of logically. You don't want to remember all the terrible recipes for food that didn't work, right? You want to lose them. You want to remember the ones that did work. But actually, for this field, it is really important. It's quite a big lesson. And on a quite a serious point is, you know, we work with a lot of governments, a lot of departments across the world. Everybody wants to celebrate and talk about the examples that work. The fact is, you should expect that the majority of things you try, if they're innovative and quirky, will not work, right? That's really important. And how do we get that information circulating? We need to be open about that. And actually, we need that list. We need that list available so that we don't keep doing other things that, you know, repeat them.
I'm curious to know if you have larger aspirations, maybe to consider how behavioral science can address core economic issues like income inequality and market failures, or issues like social mobility. Do you think about how to nudge the nudgers, the people in position to make bigger, broader applications?
So yes, I think to all those things. On the economic policy one especially, I think one of the deep ironies of behavioral economics, it hasn't been applied much to economics. I mean, imagine a labor market where you actually knew whether it's a really good place to work. Not just what you'll be paid, but, you know, how good is the boss? What are your progression opportunities? And so on and so on. Most individuals applying, they don't know the answer to those questions. And in a classical model, you sort of assume it'll work its way out. So we think there are lots of issues like that where the economy doesn't work and it takes you to a lot of policy tools. How can you help policymakers see their own failures? Behavioral government, we call it. One of the things, often the more senior you become, the more overconfident you become. And we've long thought that should be part of the story.
There's a topic you've written about in the past, social trust. Does nudge theory, if we want to call it that, is it able to be successfully applied to building social trust, do you think?
That's one of the great questions. In fact, one of the big political areas in the early days, at the same time as the behavioral insights team was being created, was then known as big society. How do you stimulate, how do you build essentially social capital, social support? Now, it fell by the wayside on the politics for various reasons, but the fundamentals of it remain absolutely key. So yes, if we take the simple trust question, do you think other people can be trusted? It's a better predictor of national economic growth rates than levels of human capital. It's phenomenally important how you feel about your fellow citizen. So, you know, beyond the shouting and the drama that was happening in Parliament, do you look over your shoulder and you don't trust your neighbor?
But do you feel that you've got tools in your arsenal that have been earned over the last 10 years that can apply to this?
I mean, there's an intervention we've done linked to itself, a big program, which is called National Citizen Service, to give young people a brief experience of volunteering community service, you know, loosely based on AmeriCorps type thing. But within it, we did an intervention testing different icebreakers. And one of the nice results was essentially getting young people to talk about in what way are we similar, because it's designed to mix people from different, you know, social backgrounds. Doesn't really seem to move the dial in relation to kids from more middle-class backgrounds, but for kids who come from quite often disadvantaged backgrounds, who their life experience may well be, actually, they can't trust people quite often. That turns out to be, that icebreaker helps to move social trust. But it's an area we're definitely very active on. What else can you do in order to build that kind of connection? An example in the UK, and probably to some extent in the US, is that people go to university, they don't end up disadvantaged in lots of ways, they earn more. But one of the things seems to be they end up with much, much more social trust and social capital. One of the factors is that you go away to university. And that actually kind of matters, that you break your social bonds from home and you mix with a whole load of, you know, other people from different backgrounds, and you generally are able to trust. You learn the habits of trust, which you then carry with you for a lifetime.
I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. If you want more of our show, subscribe to the podcast using any podcast app. You can get the entire 10-year archive on the Stitcher app or at freakonomics.com, where you can also sign up for our email newsletter. Thanks for listening.